While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon to you, Namibia, and a warm welcome to everyone tuning in from across the country and, of course, beyond the borders of Namibia. Thank you for choosing Eagle FM, the home of informed conversations and credible national dialogue. I am your host, Dafa Happy Juju, and you are tuned into On the Reading News Analysis, the program where today's headlines are examined in their full context. Now, today is Wednesday, the 4th of January, 2026, and the time is just 5 minutes past the hour, 1300 hours. Now, as the nation steps into the new year, Namibia finds itself navigating a period of heightened public expectations, questions around governance, accountability, economic resilience, and community well-being are taking center stage, with decisions made now set to influence both immediate outcomes and the country's long-term direction. Now, right here on the radar, we move beyond surface-level reporting. We unpack policy decisions, explore the motivations behind them, and assess their impact on the daily lives of Namibians, from bustling urban centers to far-reaching rural communities. Now, in a media landscape shaped by fast-paced information and competing narratives, On the Radar remains committed to grounded analysis, informed perspectives, and thoughtful engagement. Our focus is on clarity, context, and connection between national development and lived realities. From 1300 hours to 1430 every weekday, we bring you expert insight, community voices, and journalism that aims to not only inform, but to empower meaningful public dialogue. Now, you can listen to On the Radar News Analysis via Eagle FM frequencies, stream us live via the Eagle FM website, or download the Eagle FM app, and also stay connected through our WhatsApp channel for real-time updates. Now, wherever you're listening from, on the move, at work, or at home, stay with us as we examine the issues shaping Namibia's present and influencing its future. Let's get right into today's analysis. The 8th Parliament was officially opened yesterday, marking the start of a new parliamentary session and setting the legislative agenda for the year. Pardon me, the legislative agenda for the year ahead. Now, the opening signals the commencement of parliamentary business, including the tabling of bills, debate on national priorities, and strengthened oversight of the executive by elected representative. During the opening, emphasis was placed on parliament's role in advancing governance. That is, by during the opening, President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah placed emphasis on parliament's role in advancing governance, accountability, and service delivery as the country navigates ongoing economic pressures and social challenges. Now, the session also provides an opportunity for government to outline its policy direction and registry to focus under the 8th administration. The tabling of bills also forms a central part of the parliamentary process. Once tabled, a bill is formally introduced to the National Assembly for consideration and debate, and this allows members of parliament to scrutinize proposed laws, assess their alignment with the constitution, and evaluate their potential impact on citizens. Bills introduced in parliament undergo a structured process that includes readings, committee scrutiny, and public consultations before being passed by the National Assembly and reviewed by the National Council. Now, once approved by both houses and signed by the President, bills become acts of Parliament. And the opening of Parliament also reinforces Parliament's oversight function, enabling lawmakers to monitor the implementation of laws and policies and question executive decisions and represent the interest of their constituencies. The parliament session is expected to focus on key national issues, including economic recovery, pardon me, infrastructure development, access to basic services and social protection, as well as government moves to translate policy, pardon me, as government moves to translate policy commitments into registration. The official opening of parliament marks a critical moment in Namibia's democratic process, as legislative decisions taken during the session are expected to shape national outcomes in the months ahead. Now let's take a listen to Senior Public Relations Officer at the National Assembly, that is Mr. Sakeus Kadhigwa, as we engage on what this means and also the tabling of bills, and he gets into a thorough discussion or thorough educative in discussion on that. Let's take a listen. A very good afternoon to you, Mr. Sakeus Kadhigwa, and welcome to On the Radar News Analysis.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
Mr. Sakeus, of course, yesterday we witnessed the reopening of Parliament, which of course marks the formal start of a new parliamentary session. What does the reopening of Parliament actually signify in terms of the government's priorities for the new parliamentary session?
Now, thank you so much. The official opening, I should say, that is the proper way to say it, the official opening of Parliament, It's a significant national event because it formally marks the starting of the legislative year, and it sets the tone for parliamentary businesses. It also symbolizes that both the separation and unity of the three arms of the state, which is the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary, hereby reinforcing Namibia's constitutional democracy and the rule of law and good governance. So yesterday's ceremony provides an important platform for the president to address the nation or the legislative or the legislatures, reflecting on the past achievements and outlining the government's legislative agenda, policy priorities, and key bills for the year ahead. In addition, it is a major national ceremonial occasion, which has been broadcast, as we have seen it, on our platforms as well as on NBC television. This is to ensure transparency and to allow citizens to follow and engage with the democratic process. Through its formal traditions and public visibility, the official opening has reaffirmed Parliament's commitment to accountability, oversight, and service to the people of Namibia.
Let's talk about doubling of bills and get into explaining what that means in the Namibian parliamentary process.
Yes. Tabling of bills, these are now proposals to laws that come to Parliament. Bills can be tabled by any member of Parliament, be it now the ministers, the deputy ministers, and those that do not have portfolios. Any member of Parliament can table a bill. So the process of tabling a bill goes as follows. A bill can be proposed or brought to Parliament either by the executive, which is what we regard as to the ministers bringing a bill to Parliament, and it's regarded as government bill, or when the opposition or any other member that is not a minister or deputy minister brings a bill to Parliament, which is also referred to as the private member's bill. So those bills comes to Parliament, then they have been introduced, tabled, read, or it has to go through reading stages, but in most cases or sometimes it only goes until to the second stage before it goes to the third reading. It is then referred to a parliamentary standing committee who has the function of assuring that the bill is taken out to the constituents, to the electorates, or to the people down on the ground, so that the members of such a committee needs to get the get or hold meetings with government officials and different agencies just to address specific issues, or whereby they can also just summon government officials or ministries and agencies to provide explanations on policy matter or budget implementation or any other thing that relates to that specific bill that they are dealing with or that is under their jurisdiction as a committee. Or they also just conduct regional meetings to engage citizens and get public input on key issues for them to have a better understanding and for them to comprehensively also have a report that they will have to bring back to Parliament. So the chairperson of such committee will then come back to Parliament with a comprehensive report, read out the findings of the findings or what they have received from the ground. Then the bill is referred to the third reading stage. Thereafter, the bill is then passed to the National Council. At the National Council, the same process starts over again, whereby the bill has to be introduced, the bill has to be read three times, and the National Council also has parliamentary standing committees who also have the functions of assuring that this bill goes out to the regions. And since the National Council is a true reflection of the people on the ground, simply because this is where you get your constituency and regional councillors, they know or they have a better background of who are the target audience. I mean, not who are the target audience, but where are the target audience on a specific matter. Hence the committees. Then they will take this bill to those respective committees and communities. They seek also audiences in that regard. A comprehensive report is also prepared from the council's point of view. They debate it back in their chambers, and then the National Council can then prepare the bill to be referred back to the or sent back to the National Assembly. So in some instance, the bill can be referred back to the National Assembly by the National Council with or without recommendation. When a bill is referred then back to the National Assembly, at this time or at this point, the National Assembly would then approve it and prepare it to go or to be passed to the executive. At the executive stage, where the president is in charge or has the executive branch of government, the president has now the mandate or the function of assuring that she assent or dissent the bill. Once the president has assented the bill is then prepared to go to the government newspaper, which is what we call as the government gazette. Mm-hmm. Then the bill is gazetted and it becomes a law.
What are some of the factors that determine which bills are prioritized and tabled at the start of the parliamentary session?
Yes, thank you so much. Remember, Parliament does not prioritize bills. We receive all bills or we regard all bills that come to Parliament as bills that needs to be held or dealt with by the members of Parliament. And as I said, we have two types of bills that come to Parliament, and a bill, we have government bill and the private member's bill. All bills or most bills that are government bills has to go through a stage or has to be approved first by Cabinet before it is brought to Parliament. So whatever that comes to Parliament and is regarded as a government bill that needs to be tabled in Parliament by the government or by the ministers, or in the absence of the minister, it's a deputy minister, that bill should have been approved first by the CCL. It's a committee under the cabinet. It's a cabinet constitutional legal drafters, I should say. Mm-hmm. And then this bill is prepared in a language or is approved by the legal drafters. I mean, by the cabinet committee on constitutional affairs or constitutional functions. Once that bill has then been prepared in such a manner, a bill is then brought to Parliament. And then the member will table the bill, and then the House will debate on such a bill, and then the members will then look at the essence of the bill to say that, okay, fine, is this bill really talking to the aspiration and the needs of the Namibian people? Is this bill in pair with the constitutional mandate, or is this bill not infringing policies that are already existing? So those are some of the those are some of the aspects that the members of parliament or parliament in general looks at before they can pass over a bill. Indeed, yes, you have bills that are regarded as agent bill. Of course, yes, we do receive bills that are regarded as an agent bill. Agent bills are bills that look at issues of bread and butter in this country, and those bills can then be fast-tracked by the members of parliament. And when I say fast-track, it's not just a matter of it being brought to parliament and then every member of parliament it still has to go through that process, of assuring that, yes, it has... it has undergone the requirements of an appropriate bill, or regarded as an appropriate bill.
Now, Mr. Sakeus Kadekwe, the president expressed regret and disappointment in the fact that only two of the 9 budget-related bills proceeded last year, that is 2025. Now, what factors or what confidence perhaps do you have in the administration to say that they will do differently this year, and what perhaps should they do to ensure that bills are passed and actually enough bills are passed this year?
Yes, I really cannot talk on behalf of the MPs because I'm not a member of parliament. That's duly to the members of parliament themselves. But what I can say is, as I just explained, bills don't just come to parliament on their own. I mean, bills don't just appear to be in parliament.
Yeah.
Bills come to parliament provided that they have followed the procedures I've mentioned. That's very key, number one. Secondly, most bills, as I said, we have two types of bills. Most bills, especially when the president says that bills that came to parliament, bills that were sent from cabinet to parliament, those are bills that were not considered. It is that it is with the understanding that, yes, bills were not considered simply because the bills were not accepted probably by the members of parliament, or the members of parliament had to do a thorough investigation or scrutiny on this bill before they passed them. Additionally, also, last year's parliament, or the current 8th administration, which resumes its duty in March 2025, as opposed to them starting in February, because they have started in March, and then I would say that the whole of March, we really did not do any legislative. We were mostly busy with induction. That has taken also time for us to induct members of parliament, to acquaint themselves with the procedures of parliament and the work of parliament, which is actually in 3 phases that legislative oversight and representation has to also unfold at the same pace and the same time. Importantly is that when bills were submitted or when bills were received at parliament, we have received bills that also came at towards the end of the year, especially with some of the bills that came towards the end of the year. It did not give room or enough room for members of parliament to have a proper scrutiny on this bill. Hence, some of the bills were actually not passed, but were then passed to be dealt with this year. So those are some of the hindrances that could have delayed the bills not to be passed on time. Yes.
Okay.
I think I can post that.
Yeah. Okay. Now, how can ordinary Namibians follow and engage with the progress of bills tabled in parliament?
Yes. I stated that the bills are tabled. That's the first part. When a bill comes to Parliament, it needs to be tabled. When a bill is tabled, it becomes accessible, or it becomes a public document for any member of the society to access it and give their inputs, or to get a hold of such a bill and have their various contributions towards the bill. But before a bill comes to Parliament, the ministries or the what do you call them? Yeah, the ministry or the source or the institution that brought the bill to Parliament, mm-hmm. they also has a duty to assure that that bill has, or the ministry has done an extensive groundwork whereby they need to assure that engagement with the various stakeholders that will be affected or will be affected by the bill has been consulted. So consultation starts right away from the ministries at the ministry's level, which will also be continued or strengthened at the Parliament level. So those are platforms or avenues that the public are engaged. Okay. So coming back to Parliament, what we do as Parliament, we assure that the bill has reached an extensive audience, depending now on what the bill entails, and then we also sample. We sometimes sample our audiences to see that which portion of the audiences are we going to target. If not, we'll also just target all 14 regions to assure that everybody's view is being captured. So we take the bills out to the committees, or I mean to the communities, to the regions, through our parliamentary standing committees, which have the function of oversight, or through the oversight responsibility of committees. At those platforms, they engage, they consult, they invite, they lobby, and they offer someone. Okay. So those are the platforms that they can have. Mm-hmm. Apart from that, also Parliament has a bill tracking system. When this system is an open mobile app, whereby the public can also just download the app and track the existence or the where the bill is through such a particular app. Additionally, we have an open door policy at Parliament. We allow members of the public to come to Parliament either to follow the sessions, or they can follow the sessions through our electronic platforms.
Yeah.
And they can also lobby any member of Parliament of their choice should they feel like they want to contribute, or they can easily just get a hold of the bill and then give their inputs, and then they can give their inputs either in writing or in person. All avenues that are accepted at Parliament. Those are some of our platforms we have at Parliament to assure that the marginalized, the vulnerable voices, and then those that are in the grassroots levels or in the grassroots or far to reach areas are also heard.
Mr. Sakens, please speak to us on how a strong parliamentary process contributes to public trust in the government.
You see, Parliament or National Assembly, as I said, this is the legislative branch of government. This is where laws are made. And this is where the public has trusted or has entrusted their representatives to go make laws on their behalf. So the emphasis what I'm trying to bring across here is that members of Parliament are our servants. They are there on our behalf. They can only do this much provided that we also supported them. So it is important, or it is vital, that the general public should also participate and be part and parcel of the lawmaking process through the platforms as mentioned. That way we can strengthen our legislatives. Once we give a blind eye on such an activity, to allow members of Parliament to do, to what is it? to make laws without our voices. It becomes a bit challenging for us to assure that yes, this is really what we need. So all in all, what I'm trying to say is that we need to strengthen that collaboration. We need to strengthen bringing voice, our voices across, so that members of parliament can be held accountable in terms of administering and assuring that they are making laws that are of the public's concern. So the National Assembly plays a central role in promoting inclusive development and participatory democracy. That is one. And as the primary legislative body, National Assembly translates public needs into enforceable laws. It ensures equitable access to resources, and it also provides platforms for citizens, for citizen participation. It is then through this public participation that is now the public hearings, the committee work, and stakeholders' consultation that Parliament allows Namibians to contribute to the lawmaking process, as I said earlier. And also, just to answer your question, we, Parliament, as the House of the Lawmaking, National Assembly also addresses the historical imbalances that promote equality and exercises oversight over the executive to ensure accountability, transparency, and good governance. These are all key areas that I'm trying to emphasize what will strengthen and what will actually strengthen the parliament processes. In essence, what I'm trying to say is that parliament ensures that laws reflect the aspirations of the people and support an inclusive participatory democracy.
Let me just say this.
I think you can capture this better from the questions that you asked. The lawmaking process. When a ministry or office wishes to make a law, whether it's now a new or an amendment to an existing law, it must ideally develop a policy document that's set and summer. Secondly, the ministry or office must consult the Attorney General on proposed laws to ensure its constitutionality or to determine whether the proposed policy can't be achieved in some other way. That's number one. Then once that has been exhausted, then the ministry or office prepares a layperson's bill or a policy statement and a memorandum to cabinet together with an explanatory note. This layman's bill policy statement with explanatory notes is then submitted to cabinet committee on legislation for discussion. So the layman's bill or policy statement, once it's submitted to our cabinet, it's then approved in principles. Thereafter, the bill is then submitted to legislative drafters for scrutiny and drafting. The legislative drafters scrutinize it and draft the bill. The bill is then submitted to the ministry or the center of the initiator of the bill for approval. So then this bill is then submitted to the Cabinet Committee on Legislation, back again to Cabinet, for certification and transition to the National Assembly for printing and tabling. At the parliamentary stage, the bill undergoes then the three reading stages, as I've mentioned it earlier, in both the National Assembly and the National Council. And it's then passed in accordance with parliamentary procedures and the constitution. Thereafter, the bill is then prepared to go for to the president for the president's signing, for the president to sign the bill, and then the bill, once the bill has been signed by the president, the bill is then published in the Gazette. Now the bill is now becoming an act.
Mm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
That's how a bill is actually converted into an act or into a law. Those are the steps. I think I was rambling about the cabinet committee that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So the right naming of the committee is called the Cabinet Committee on Legislation.
Okay.
That's where the bill goes.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm. Very informative. Thank you so much, Mr. Sakeus Kadhikwa, for such.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Okay, and then we had it from Mr. Sakeus Kadhikwa. Now, Sakeus Kadhikwa is the Senior Public Relations Officer within the National Assembly. For now, let's pause right here. Take a trip to the marketplace. But of course, we have yet more coming your way. Stay tuned right here on the Reader News Analysis.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
Ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatuimwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile ko berewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu batatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back. Still on this, we caught up with Lainey Jonas, and she's a political science student and a youth advocate. Let's take a listen to that conversation.
A very good afternoon to you, Lainey Jonas, and welcome to On the Reader News Analysis.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for the warm welcome.
Sure, pleasure is all mine. Now, of course, yesterday we witnessed the official opening of the third session of the 8th Parliament. Now, for you being a politician yourself, if I put it rightly, what does this signify or what does this entail for the Namibian people?
I believe this for the Namibian people is us giving our leaders another chance, another year to go out there and to deliver what they have promised, which is exactly why we have voted them in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a moment of celebration, but definitely there are very high expectations from the Namibian youth at large.
Hmm. Interesting. Talking about the youth, do you think the youth has confidence and are really behind members of parliament? I mean, we see young people in parliament, and this was the cry of the youth for quite a very long time. They want people to represent them, people who I think they feel like they can be able to relate to, people who understand their challenges. What do you think would be probably the voice of the youth in this regard?
I think in this regard, the youth definitely does have confidence in its leaders. It definitely does have confidence, and I believe that we still have hope. But the youth's confidence is also very much under pressure because the delays frustrate young people, especially when they're struggling with unemployment, which is a big crisis here in Namibia, the lack of opportunities, and so on. I believe the confidence will return when they see real action and real results from their leaders.
Mm. Now, speaking about that, let's get into the into the president's speech yesterday. I take it that you followed as well yourself, being a political student, and obviously the subjects that are of keen interest to you. What do you make of the president's speech yesterday?
I think the president's tone was very firm. She is basically saying that leadership comes with responsibility and that parliament must rise to the expectations of the people. Mm-hmm. So her disappointment that she expressed is less about blame and more about performance. And initially she asked the parliamentarians to sift up the process and to collaborate more and to ensure that they actually keep their trust in the people.
Mm. Talking about collaboration, just how do you think perhaps they can actually collaborate as members of parliament, different opposition parties, different people?
Mm-hmm.
How do you suggest they actually collaborate to ensure that the bills that are being tabled are executed mm-hmm. well and fast enough?
I think I would like parliamentarians to first recommit themselves to why they are in parliament in the first place, which is to serve the people. That means providing attendance, acting participatively in debate, and prioritizing the passage of bills that directly affect the service delivery.
Yeah.
Because I think in this case, for example, if it's a bill on health, on education, on jobs, imagine somewhere out there, there's a young person that's waiting for job opportunities, there's someone sick waiting for healthcare services that are not coming. So I think I would also love to see a stronger collaboration across political leaders in parliament, of course, because development should never be held hostage by political differences, which are President also beautifully mentioned yesterday. I think lastly, I believe Parliament must adopt a results-driven culture with clear timelines for processing bills so that by the end of the year, we can point to concrete laws, pause, and actually see real improvements in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Talking about political differences, how should politicians strike a balance between removing their hats or their caps? And I don't mean in a literal sense, and actually working mm-hmm. together as members of parliament, but we've been voted by the people, as you rightly alluded to earlier. When do they actually they need to put their hats off and work together? And how do you think this will really translate into tangible results?
I believe parliamentarians should strike a balance from the very start of the legislative year.
Mm.
And we're at the beginning of the year, so it's like the perfect time, basically. Collaboration shouldn't just happen when a crisis arises or when the president expresses a concern such as this. They need to agree on priorities early on in their sessions, identifying bills that affect service delivery and national development, and work across party lines to actually move forward efficiently. I think another healthy debate is also I believe that recently they've been saying they don't want debate in parliament, right?
Mm.
But I believe that healthy debates are actually essential, but it should never delay outcomes that directly impact people, because at the end of the day, they are there to deliver for their people, to make a difference, to make sure that social and economic development actually goes forward.
Mm.
So I believe that by combining robust discussions with shared commitment to results, they can actually ensure legislation serves its best purpose without being botched down by politics in the future.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about the people, of course, Parliament is also open to the public for them to also play their part in lawmaking. Of course, in bills also being tabled, they also have their part to play. But we do know that a lot of Namibian people a lot of Namibian people don't really participate. The only participation sometimes that you would see is comments on Facebook. What do you think about this particular aspect of itself, of people allowing parliamentarians to make decisions without actually them getting involved, although the law gives them the platform to actually get involved?
I think this is actually a very important point, especially for the Namibian youth. I don't say they are naive, but I think a lot of people are very avoidant and they don't see the significance of actually actively taking part in politics. So I think I would actually urge the Namibian youth to take part. You know, you can't complain about service delivery when you're not doing anything to actually make sure that the leaders in those positions are also delivering.
Mm-hmm.
So it's little things like going to parliament, actually watching sessions. And one thing about our leaders and one thing they urge the youth to do is always, you know, you can ask questions, you can pose your questions. If you're not happy, you're very likely to go to the prime minister's office. If you complain to him, he's going to make a change.
Mm. Indeed, something that I think take for granted. I'm not so sure if other people really have that privilege to actually do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. and for some youth, they're actually really right there in the capital city. They can just pop up at parliament and also partake. Yeah, but.
Literally.
Yeah. But mm-hmm. overall, Loini, what is it that you would say in regards to the official opening of the 8th administration? What is it that you are expecting from the 8th administration?
What am I expecting from the 8th administration?
Yeah.
I'm expecting Parliament to take the President's message seriously and show real results this year, actually, and prioritize bills that affect people, especially the youth. Mm. And I think with this change, that means more bills being passed, especially those that directly affect people's lives, like mental health services, land reform, and public enterprise government, because this is also a way for the youth to actually get into the business structure and just do something for themselves. I also expect stronger collaboration between parties with debates that are actually constructive rather than blocking progress.
Mm.
Ultimately, I'm expecting action, tangible outcomes that improve service delivery, create opportunities for the Namibian youth, and rebuild public confidence in our elected representatives. I believe that we still have a long term in order for our current leaders to actually, you know, pass it on to the next people.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe one way to actually bring about change is to see the mistakes that they're making. And I think those have been brought about, or some of them have been brought about yesterday.
Yeah.
So I believe that 2026 will actually be a better year. I believe that this year bills will actually be prioritized and they will be very quick on delivery.
Interesting. Loini, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reader News Analysis. We do appreciate your time with us.
Mm-hmm. It was a pleasure.
Sure. And of course, that was the voice of Loini Jonas, a political science student and a youth advocate. Yeah. Now let's talk about registry. Let's talk about the three arms of government in Namibia. Of course, we've had very well from Sakeus Kadhikwa educating us thoroughly on that. But just let me get a little bit into the basics also. Now, Namibia operates a constitutional democracy based on the separation of powers as provided for in the Constitution of the Republic of Namibia. Government power is divided into three arms, that is the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. Now, if you're a history student yourself, you will probably remember some of the things that you were taught in the history class. For myself, I do remember, I think that was grade 10. This is something that we were taught. Now the legislature in Namibia is the arm of government responsible for making laws in Namibia. Namibia's legislature is the parliament, which consists of the National Assembly and the National Council. Now, the functions of the legislature are to enact and amend laws, to represent the interests of the Namibian people, approve the national budget, exercise oversight over the executive, ratify international agreements, and debate national issues. Now, the legislature ensures that laws reflect the will and the needs of the Namibian people. And the executive is responsible for implementing and administering laws passed by parliament. That is the composed of the President of Namibia,
that is the head of state and the government, the cabinet, including the prime minister and the ministers, and the government ministries, offices, and agencies. The function of the executive is to implement laws passed by parliament, formulate and execute government policies, maintain national security and public order, manage foreign relations, and prepare the national budget. The executive ensures effective governance and national development through the implementation of laws. Now, the judiciary, on the other hand, is the arm of government responsible for interpreting the law and administering justice. It composes of the Supreme Court of Namibia, the High Court of Namibia, the lower courts and tribunals. The functions of the judiciary are to interpret the constitution and other laws, to also to resolve disputes between individuals and the state, to protect fundamental human rights, review the constitutionality of laws and executive actions, as well as to ensure equality before the law. Now, the importance of the judiciary is to uphold the rule of law and to ensure justice and fairness in Namibia. In a particular part that we did hear from Mr. Sakeus Kandekwa is the importance of public participation in lawmaking in Namibia. Now, public participation in lawmaking is a key democratic principle in Namibia and is supported by the Constitution. Reasons being for this, why it's important, is that it strengthens democracy as citizens influence laws that govern them, and it also ensures that laws reflect the Namibian realities, the lived realities of the Namibian people. Therefore, input from communities help parliament address real social and economic challenges. We also had him talk about parliament standing committee that then go and visit communities. Just the other time we spoke about the parliament standing committee visiting Oshochenzo region, and they go on to visit last year. I do remember speaking about parliament standing committee visiting Angela Hospital. That is that side is it in Enana or passing Enana somewhere that side. It also promotes transparency and accountability by open participation, which reduces then corruption and abuse of power. Furthermore, it improves compliance with laws, and citizens are more likely to obey laws they understand and help shape them. Now, it also further protects human rights, that is by public involvement, helping to prevent unconstitutional or discriminatory laws. It further encourages national unity and development, that is by inclusive lawmaking, which promotes social cohesion and sustainable development. Another aspect that I want to talk about is how President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah expressed the disappointment in bills that were not enough bills that were passed last year. This was due to, of course, debates and scrutiny from what opposition leaders, opposition parties say that they needed to scrutinize. And judging from this angle, I would say, I think it's yes, more bills could have been passed last year, but I think we could also give them the benefit of the doubt, as this is the new administration. A lot of them are very new to parliament, and of course they needed to learn how to go about, though the induction was done in March last year. And I think those months run about, according to the senior public relations officer at the National Assembly. And of course, they needed to understand how exactly laws are passed, or scrutinizing of bills. And then again, they are young people indeed, and they want to really scrutinize a bill as opposed to just passing them in haste, just to ensure that bills are passed. So somehow we do give them the benefit of the doubt, and we hope that this year there will be less debate. And of course, we had from Loini Jonas also saying that constructive debates are necessary, but then they shouldn't. Debates also should be well controlled, well crafted, so to say, so as not to waste time on unnecessary debates, not waste time, and rather get into real discussion, tangible discussion. One thing I would want to see from the 8th administration, as officially opened yesterday,
as Parliament was officially opened yesterday, is that I would want collaboration indefinitely with respect, you know, whereby people are respecting each other and collaborating together to actually get somewhere. You know, I think it's about time that politicians come together and put off their hat. Of course, like I say, not in a literal sense, but put off their hat and work together for the Namibian people who elected them. At the end of the day, we do want a cohesion. We do want collaboration so that the Namibian people can benefit from those bills, from those amendment of bills and all that, for our own benefit and for all our own benefit. I mean, at the end of the day, any party would say that they want the benefit of the Namibian people. Hence why I think sometimes it's necessary to put away political differences and work together for the betterment of the people, enacting laws that, of course, benefit the Namibian people. Now, of course, let's pause right here. Now, should you be interested in asking questions or contributions right here on the Reader News Analysis, please dial in on 083-288-401. That is the number in studio, 083-288-401. With that being said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly for more. Stay tuned.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
Ninge kwa tafano na Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile ko berewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Now, something that I did overlook is ways that Namibians can participate in lawmaking. As much as we did hear from Mr. Zakaria, Kadikwa, there are certain ways that Namibians can participate in lawmaking. One is by attending public hearings organized by the National Assembly or the National Council. And secondly, is by making submissions or petitions to parliamentary committees, engaging also with members of parliament and the National Council representatives, also participating in civil society organizations and community forums, especially when parliament standing committees come to their community or their village to do oversight of certain projects. Now following also parliamentary debates through media and official channels could also help them in being participants of the law. Now let's take you to news beyond the borders of Namibia. Before we do that, let's tell you what's happening in terms of economic indicators. Now, $1 today is equals to 11.20. $1 today is equals to 15
5.96 Namibian dollars. And 1 Swiss franc is equals to 20 Namibian dollars and 55 cents, while 1 pound sterling is equals to 21 Namibian dollars and 87 cents. 1 Australian dollar is the one which is equals to 11.20 Namibian dollars, and 1 Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 16 cents. And with that being said, we now switch over to news beyond the borders of Namibia. Let's start off in South Africa, where DA's future is in focus amid leadership developments. Let's take a listen to that.
Let's continue taking stock of this moment, bring in once again our senior politics reporter, Samkele Maseko, with us in studio. You know, if John Steenhuisen's speech was a poem, I think people will speak of a motif.
Now, some joke.
Undercurrent that runs through the poem where you constantly evoke an idea or an image to drive your point. And for him, he spoke a lot about standing on the tip of the Union buildings, right, and looking over the country's capital, and that's when all these reflections came to him. And I can imagine a scenario where many point to that as his big achievement, right? He was the guy at the helm of the DA when they got to the Union buildings. And I wonder whether you reckon, you know, that's what it comes down to.
Will it be the last time he's at the Union buildings? What is he planning next? He says this is not the end of John Steenhuisen. In speeches of that nature, where someone is saying goodbye but not saying goodbye, you must decode the speech. There's a particular segment where he said that we must not let anyone derail the project and not let internal factional reactions derail the project of building South Africa from the destroyers, from the doomsday coalition. He's painting a picture of a party that is deeply divided and fraught with challenges of the government of national unity and how the DA's identity, seemingly by some within the Democratic Alliance, they feel as if has been swallowed and killed because of the DA's association and close proximity to the ANC in the form of the government of national unity. You'd remember there was a battle in the DA where there were questions that you've lost the Bella Act, it's signed into law. The Expropriation Act is signed into law.
NHI
was signed into law. All of the radical policies the DA perceives the ANC to be pursuing, the DA was just rubber stamping them. And that caused internal divisions within the ANC, which prompted the DA to come out and speak and say they won't pass the budget. There was the issue of the value-added tax VAT increase that ultimately had the DA negotiating over the budget speech and the DA going into an all-important meeting where the president was meant to go abroad and ended up not going, where the DA was contemplating getting out of the government of national unity. And that time it was the Helen Zille faction versus the John Steenhuisen faction within the Democratic Alliance, which is where I draw the parallels in the speech that you should not let anyone or factional battles within the party derail the DA's achievement of being a party of government now, rather than a mere opposition.
I am struggling to understand if, for example, this had been such a big deal, why a John Steenhuisen would walk away now. Right? If it had cost so much to get us here, and if you had been at the helm, arguably had major sacrifices, why pull the trigger at this moment?
What is the content of the FLC report that the DA had commissioned, the Federal Legal Commission report? We've not had good feedback on that as yet. He may have been cleared on the issue of the credit card and using it to buy Uber Eats for himself or for anyone else. But all his other issues that he was shrouded in, the issue of the ruling against him by the courts on his debt, on his credit card debt, his lifestyle that he lives, particularly living, quote unquote, above his own means, being too close to the African National Congress, being too consumed by the sins of incumbency of government. Those are some of the issues that his detractors in the DA are saying that you are not the guy, you are not the leader to take the DA to its next phase. And he himself said, I have achieved everything that I have sought to achieve. We are now a party in government. I said I would do that as I looked on the steps of the Union buildings. but this is not the end of the road for me. If he's saying this is not the end of the road for him, and is going to support the newly elected DA leader in April, politically, then what is his next move? Because in order for you to climb the political ladder to be president of South Africa, ultimately you must have to lead one of the political parties in the country.
Oh, don't tell me something.
I'm not going there. But history has proven that when young politicians, relatively young, you don't retire politically at that age that John Steenhuisen is in or at this point in time. We now have to ponder his retreat from the Western Cape to go back to his base in KZN. What is he trying to do? Is he riling up support within the party outside of its formal structures? And what is he riling that support for going into the future? It is up to you to deduce what I'm saying.
Right. Okay. As the cliche goes, time will tell. We do know there's an important election coming up in a few months' time. Before I let you go, as we continue digesting this, the obvious question is what happens next for the DA? There is at least one name that's been thrown out there as a possible strong contender to be the successor. But it also gives us an opportunity to take stock of some of the other, perhaps more promising candidates potentially who might throw their names into the hat.
It's going to be an interesting road for the DA going forward. Gordon Hill-Lewis is a rising star within the Democratic Alliance. He's been seen by many as a possible contender, but his stature within South African politics nationally, he's not that known. He may be known as the mayor of the city of Cape Town, but beyond the shores of Cape Town, will he be sellable to the rest of South Africa? That may be what the DA's internal polling has shown, that he's relatively sellable. They can salvage whatever they can salvage electorally and get a reasonable percentage electorally in the 2026 local government elections and ultimately the 2029 national elections. You've got the likes of Siviwe Khwaruba, who's been touted about to be in the top echelons of the DA. You've got Solly Malatsi, currently also in the top echelons of the DA. But you've got to be cognizant that the DA does not want to lose its core traditional base, which is the conservative Afrikaner community. And if they lose that base will go to a Freedom Front Plus. And the DA will lose its leverage and control in many respective communities that are largely donors of the Democratic Alliance. So ultimately, John Steenhuisen fell out of favor with the donors, fell out of favor with Helen Zille, who ultimately has seen, quote unquote, as Godzilla. And what Helen wants, Helen gets. Sure. Many people may accuse us of saying, no, you are promoting Helen Zille too much as the politician within the country. But ultimately, she has proven to have a thick skin politically and able to take the difficult decisions that many are unable to take. Whether she wants Gordon Hill-Lewis or not is debatable. But there are many others whom are rising within the DA and whom have been there for years and whom are also looking at that leadership title of the DA with the hawk's eye. We can't rule out individuals like J.P. Smith. He's the ultimate political survivor. He ultimately runs the DA in the Western Cape and in the metro of Cape Town. So you've got to also look at those individuals as well who are able to fit in all sectors of society. But one thing for sure, there will be no project of skin color being played this time around. An experimental project.
Right.
As was once said.
To quote what was once said by a former leader of the DA. So Gilly, before you and I get into trouble, let me thank you very much indeed for helping us take stock of that moment. And it is an important moment. Samkele Maseko is our senior politics reporter here at the SABC News Channel. And we'll certainly continue getting you reaction as we make sense of what's likely to unfold for the future of what is currently the second largest party in the country.
Well, expert explains water system recovery challenges that I see in Johannesburg. Let's take a listen.
Joburg residents are breathing a sigh of relief this morning after water supply was finally restored in areas that were recently affected by long-standing outages. The restoration follows repair work and interventions that's aimed at stabilizing the system. Monitoring continues as reservoirs recover, but the disruptions have caused widespread inconvenience for many. Let's speak a bit more about this and bring in our guest. Gugulethu Quma is a manager with Electromechanical, who will give us hopefully some insights into these challenges and whether or not we should expect similar scenes in the coming days. Gugulethu, thanks for your time. Welcome to the SABC News Channel. So between power failures, infrastructure failures, critically low reservoirs and leakages at some stage, this really does feel like it was the perfect storm for some of the most affected residents, especially those living in areas like Midrand.
Good morning to you and good morning to the viewers. Thank you for the opportunity. Yes, the last 2 weeks has been difficult, experiencing challenges from power cuts, power trips, and also the leaks and some repairs that needed to be done by our bulk supplier, in this case, Renwood. And of course, being the bulk distributor, it affects the downstream system within the value chain of water, which is Johannesburg Water Systems. And the most areas that were affected is Midrand, followed by Sandton. But there is restoration in Sandton, and now we are focusing on the Midrand side, which had also another, like you've indicated, perfect storm, where now there was a leak on the main reservoir, needed some attention, which is now back into full pumping capacity, and restoration is in progress since yesterday.
We've been told for years now that our infrastructure cannot keep up with demand, and we'll speak about what residents can do, but I wonder, Gugulethu, whether what we saw over the past couple of days was avoidable, given just how much pressure the system has been under.
We can put in some mitigation. Understandable that we do have quite a huge backlog as far as infrastructure is concerned. And looking at Midrand itself, Midrand is growing. If you're looking at the past, let's say, 30 years, you can see how Midrand has grown up to today. And if you're looking at the next 10-year horizon, you can see the future developments that will still come. Of course, there are approved plans as far as additional reservoirs and the infrastructure that is built there. Currently, some are in construction and currently some are on design stage, or future plans that are already within the next 5 to 10 years in the medium to long term period. So those infrastructure will be built. But at this stage, the infrastructure that we do have, we do understand is constrained, and it does offer some form of retention capacity, but not as desired, which means if there are prolonged outages like the one we have, we are now prone to have challenges where the reservoirs will go to critical low. So in essence, yes, some of the challenges could be cushioned, but the ones that we are facing now, definitely not, because it's power cuts, it's the leaks that needs to be repaired, and those kind of unplanned maintenance needs to be implemented, and the challenges we're facing.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Gugulethu. The mayor of the city was actually on this channel last night, and I think he spoke about building 4 reservoirs, which in my mind sounds like something that's going to take quite some time. The question becomes what the immediate solution is. I mean, for example, should residents around the city anticipate more days like what we've seen in the week gone by?
If there are unplanned challenges, yes, we will have some disruption. And definitely is a challenge that we have, because the infrastructure that we have is the one that is going to deliver the immediate solution. We need to utilize what we have to ensure that there's access to water and there's available water within the Midrand, and also all the areas within the city of Joburg. We need to rely on what we have. There is a couple of infrastructure projects, including those 4 reservoirs and towers that are being built in Midrand. Some are on construction and some are within the short to medium term that will be built to augment and add the storage within Midrand, so that we can have prolonged retention period. Whenever we have problems, we can rely on our internal storage to cushion the residents and businesses and all affected stakeholders within the area of Midrand.
We were warned that we'd get here, and it seems we're starting to see the early signs of that. Gugulethu Quma, thanks very much indeed for giving us your insights as we make sense of this moment. Really do appreciate it. Gugulethu is a manager with Electromechanical. Once again, thanks very much indeed.
Let's cross over to Zambia now, as Zambia targets 10,000 megawatts power expansion.
Has taken center stage in Africa's energy future, hosting one of the continent's most important
investment forums for the first time. The Continental Energy and Infrastructure Investment Forum, CIF 2026, has opened in Lusaka, marking the first time the event is being held outside South Africa, a major signal of growing investor confidence in Zambia. President Hage Ndehijilema officially opened the forum, calling for stronger African partnerships to unlock billions in energy and infrastructure investment. The president says Zambia has set an ambitious target of increasing power generation from 3,500 megawatts to 10,000 megawatts as part of a long-term plan to help build a single African power market.
We as a country, for the first time, have decided as government to set targets, delivery targets, to move away from the disease of talk and grandstanding to actually targets for which we work to deliver. In energy, you've heard already the minister talking of 10 gigawatts, from 3.5 gigawatts when we came into office. And we're on our way. But within this target, the mix is clearly spelled out, what we're looking for in terms of solar, in terms of course, we can't abandon hydro. As you know, the tariff around hydro is more palatable to the consumers, but also on the clean core technologies.
President Hijilema also raised concerns over Africa's regional power systems, saying Zambia failed to import electricity during the recent drought despite existing interconnectors. He cited the missing transmission links with Tanzania and the Democratic Republic of Congo, arguing that Africa has power but lacks the infrastructure to move it where it is needed.
As we experienced drought ourselves here, we had a situation where we had capacity to import, the economy has the capacity to import, but the existing arrangement under the Southern African power pool could not allow us to bring in the power, even where we have interconnectors, for different reasons. And it shouldn't take presidents to meet to unlock those issues. It should take you people seated in this room. And you can spare us to do things that are probably not well placed for you to do. But we are here, we are supportive. I think these are, again, the little issues we need to deal with, the frameworks we set, the regulations we set must work, especially when they are needed to work.
President Hijilema reiterated the need to address high project costs due to wrong risk profiling and setting regional energy targets. He highlighted Zambia's efforts in reforms and energy investments. The president further addressed the strategic importance of regional economic integration, the role of infrastructure corridors, and the need for stable political environments to attract investments.
Lobito Corridor, madam, you talked about. Tazara Corridor comes through us. We are at the center. Beira Corridor, Nacala Corridor, the Durban Corridor, if you want to call it Durban, the corridor, comes through us. Talk of the air links, 1 hour, 40 minutes to Johannesburg. Literally, it's between 1 hour or under 1 hour. If you want to go to our Siamese twins, we call ourselves Zimzam. Right? Zambia and Zimbabwe, Zimzam. 40 minutes, you're in Harare. Go to Maputo, go to anywhere. It's well under 3 hours. I was in Dodoma not long ago. 1 hour, 55 minutes. This is an excellent location for investment.
African Union Commissioner for Infrastructure and Energy, Lerato Matebonge, says Africa cannot achieve energy security through isolated national grids, but must build on a single integrated continental power market.
That is why the African Union is operationalizing the African Single Electricity Market, an initiative that connects Africa's five regional power pools into a single continental market.
The four-day forum brings together governments, investors, and development partners to mobilize billions of dollars into Africa's energy and infrastructure future. For Zambia, the message is clear. The country is no longer just seeking investment, but positioning itself as a regional power hub for the continent. Sharon Siame, ZNBC News.
You know, FNB Zambia Chief Executive Kola Kapumpepe is speaking on trade corridors, capital, and the mining's next phase.
In mining at Indawa, which is currently themed around stronger together, progress through partnerships. I'm pleased to, you know, to welcome Ms. Apulipe Chola, who's the Chief Executive Officer of FNB Zam. Ms. Chola, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Mwelo. It's always a pleasure to engage in important discussions shaping Zambia's economy and, you know, the overall interplay with the rest of the region.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, can you highlight to us in brief on the trade enablement along the Lobito Corridor and the significance of the corridor?
Okay. So trade enablement along the Lobito Corridor refers to financial services, regulatory requirements, you know, the logistical and digital mechanisms that allow goods, services, and capital to flow across borders efficiently. The Lobito Corridor, as you know, is earmarked to be one of the most important trade and logistical infrastructure routes stretching from Zambia and DRC and extending to the Lobito port in Angola. And this corridor will link some of the world's richest mineral and agricultural resources in the region to global markets across the Atlantic West. As you know, the Lobito Corridor will materially improve logistics and efficiency by reducing transit times across borders, reducing the congestion risk and unit transport costs from this rich region of the Copper Belt into global markets of the West. As you know, these efficient logistics along the Lobito Corridor would do more than facilitate raw material exports. They will lower the cost of production, attract downstream investments, and create partnerships. We're talking about partnerships at the mining endeavor, and create conditions for local processing and manufacturing to take root in Zambia and the other countries in the region. While the Lobito Corridor is often thought about as a railway corridor project, it is actually better understood as a multi-sectoral economic corridor. And I think really that is how we should look at it.
The importance of mining for economic development in this region and across the continent cannot be overstated. Could you highlight some of the key trends as a bank that you're picking up on the center?
What we're seeing now is really an acceleration of critical minerals production. There is also more focus from pure extraction to value addition. We see trade corridor-led mining. And this again talks to the importance of partnerships, you know, rising ESG and other regulatory expectations, digitalization and automation of mining operations. We've seen the use of AI in exploration services and mining. And it also brings about the issue of energy security as a major constraint in mining. And so there's a lot of work being conducted across the region to enhance and improve energy sources so that it can help and enable mining operations across the entire region.
Now, integrated financial solutions is a critical element of trade enablement. Could you tell us what support, especially from FNB perspective, is available to the corridor?
Okay, so integrated financial solutions really refers to end-to-end approaches to meeting clients' financial needs. And you do this by combining multiple banking services or offerings, adding in their risk management and advisory services, to the mining operations into one structured solution. And what this does is really drives a lot more towards building solutions for specific mining operations. So you're really more starting from the back end of understanding what a client's problems are and then building a solution specifically, a fully integrated financial solution specifically to meet that client's financial needs. You typically will do this on a large scale for large operations. But integrated financial solutions also play a critical role in supporting clients across the entire value chain. In mining, for example, integrated financial solutions would mean seamless financial flows through to the extraction, mineral value added industries, as well as enabling direct linkages to the export markets. So we as FNB are looking to support these value chains very extensively, and we've been doing it for mining companies, mining contractors, logistics providers, and also to the off-takers, which will operate along the Lobito corridor.
Right. Now, one can already tell that there's some sort of a union or intersection between, you know, the Lobito corridor and IFS. How do the Lobito corridor and IFIS work together to unlock value for mining and mineral sector?
So the way to look at this is that the Lobito corridor will provide the financial infrastructure for moving minerals and mineral value-added products, and very efficiently, of course, while the integrated financial solutions will provide the financial infrastructure that enables this trade to happen flawlessly. Together, they will create a fully integrated ecosystem where goods, capital, and services can flow a lot more effectively and efficiently. So this combination allows mining companies to scale operation, manage their risks in their operations, and access international markets more effectively. Ultimately, this unlocks greater value chains to the entire mining ecosystem.
Now, this is quite interesting. How does this align with FNB's broader strategy for mining and trade in Africa?
So FNB Zambia, as you know, works very closely with the Rand Merchant Bank team in South Africa, where we have a lot of the expertise in supporting large-scale operations across multiple sectors, whether you're talking about mining, manufacturing, energy, or agriculture. And borrowing from this expertise, we support economic activity through integrated financial solutions that drive regional and global competitiveness. We are a key player in many markets across Africa where we have representation, but we also support our clients across markets where we actually don't have operations, and also leveraging off our global footprint with our office in China, the UK, and the United States, we're able to provide global solutions to all our key clients. But I'd like to add that we support clients across the ecosystem as well. So as much as I say we support large-scale operations, we also support small, medium, and micro enterprises across many of our markets. So we are really playing a part in economic activity of all the key, across all the key sectors in many markets.
Ms. Chola, thank you so much for sharing these invaluable insights, especially ahead of the 2026 edition of Investing in Mining in DAO.
Thank you very much, Mola, for the opportunity, to all of you as well. We're very excited to be part of this year's Mining in DAO, and we really do believe in that progress through partnerships. We do it, and we have partners across many, many countries, but we also have we think of ourselves as a partner to all our clients as well. So thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. And thank you to our viewers who stay tuned to listen to this invaluable conversation. Financial Insight will be with FNB Zambia at the 2026 edition of Investing in Mining in DAO. And to our viewers, we ask you to continue to follow the insights that will come from the FNB.
Meanwhile, the UN is set to deploy ceasefire monitoring team in Uvira, DRC, Congo.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, is preparing to deploy its first ceasefire monitoring team in the coming days, according to Qatar's foreign ministry. The team is expected to go to Uvira, a strategic city in the east that was recently retaken by government forces after the M23 rebels withdrew. Qatar says both sides have agreed on terms for the monitoring mechanism under a previous ceasefire deal, signaling progress in Doha-mediated negotiations. Separate U.S.-led talks between the DRC and Rwanda are also underway. This latest push to activate ceasefire monitoring comes amid persistent fighting in the east, which has faced decades of conflict, which has caused ongoing instability and a worsening humanitarian crisis. Let's get more on this. For more on this, we are now joined by our correspondent, Chris Ochimringa, who is live for us in Kinshasa. Chris, welcome to the program. Welcome to Africa Live. Thank you for joining us. Chris, first and foremost, a ceasefire monitoring team is due to arrive in the eastern town of Uvira. What more can you tell us about its mandate, duration, and operations? What do we know?
Well, Richard, the spokesperson of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the DRC confirmed the deployment of UN peacekeepers in the eastern city of Uvira in the coming days. She said that they are carrying out preparations to deploy the troops and declined to divulge more details about, you know, the duration and the operations, how it will be going on. But what we know is that the peacekeepers will be deployed there to protect civilians, which is their core mandate. You know, last month when M23 rebels were pulling out of that city after getting a lot of pressure from the United States, they wrote a letter to the United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, asking him to send a neutral force to protect civilians in that area, particularly the Tutsi community known as Banyamulenge, who they said were at risk of being attacked by the Wazalendo militia, who are a group that has been fighting alongside the DRC army. But the DRC dismissed that allegation, saying that they are not targeting any civilians in Uvira. They are only fighting against the M23 rebels who have illegally occupied territories in eastern DRC, as well as the Rwandan forces, despite UN Security Council resolution known as 2773, which called on them to stop the offensive and the Rwandan soldiers to withdraw from Congolese territory. So we're expecting the United Nations peacekeeping mission to make a statement about how this deployment will be carried out in the next coming days. Richard?
Let's talk more about that important background for our clarification there. Thank you so much. Now, this will be the first team deployed by the UN, Chris. How is the government in Kinshasa reacting to the developments, and what are the expectations, most importantly, on the ground?
Well, authorities in Kinshasa.
And I wouldn't want to take up more time on the Konana Dengue program. So let's pause right here now and hand over the mic to my colleague, Lois Eshimi, as she brings you the Konana Dengue program. Now, from me, the Afa Happy Juju, it is goodbye. That's all what we have for you today on the Reader News Analysis. Goodbye.